Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me Neil Denny and with a guest host, Dan Schreiber. Dan Schreiber is the co-creator and producer of BBC Radio 4's Museum of Curiosity, an occasional QIL. He does stand-up comedy, sometimes in Mandarin, and is an expert on all things Brian Blessed. And Dan is now about to introduce our actual guest this week.
Yeah, the guest this week is Mark Abrams, editor and co-founder of the science humor magazine Annals of Improbable Research and its website improbable.com. He's also the founder and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony, which honors achievements in science that have to make you laugh before making you think. Prizes are handed out by a genuine Nobel laureate at a gala ceremony held each October at Harvard University and are broadcast on National Public Radio and on the internet. He's also a weekly columnist for The Guardian, an author of many books, including Ig Nobel books and the Improbable Research books. You're actually going with The Guardian now, aren't you, as a TV element?
We're talking about doing some extra things in addition to the print. Yeah, I've done a few, taking some old columns of rather unusual things and turning them into little TV things that go in previously unthinkable directions.
Oh, yeah?
For example, one is about the longest... This column is unusual. I write about anything, as long as it's something that will, I hope, grab people's attention in a direction that they had never dreamed they would be going. So one of them is about the longest oath on record uttered officially and by requirement in a court case. And it was in an Indian court from about 200 or 300 years ago. It was the standard oath that every witness was supposed to take. There's an old book, you can read this. And it goes on for about 20 minutes. and it's not simply dealing with the kinds of topics you would probably get here, but I promise to tell the truth. And they elaborate there. So you have to give lots of examples, read them. You don't get to make this up, about horrible things that you have not done and far worse things that will happen to you, that you are begging will happen to you from all kinds of gods and supernatural agents if you utter the least bit of untruth. So we did that as a video piece.
That's amazing. Did you read the there was a story about Indian court of law as well, where two families were having a dispute about land and who owned it, and one side was claiming a certain god said it was their land and the other was saying it was another god. So the way the judge resolved it was to send a typed up letter from the court to the gods asking them to appear in court to testify for their side, and if neither did, then that sort of reasoning would be invalid.
King Solomon at work in the Indian court. The Indian land system seems to give birth to all kinds of unexpected things. We gave an Ig Nobel Prize. The prize is, I think you mentioned it, for achievements that make people laugh and then make them think in anything. We gave a prize, I guess about 10 years ago now, it was the Ig Nobel Peace Prize, to an Indian man named Lal Bihari, who is the founder and president of the Association of Dead Persons. Are you familiar with this?
No.
Some parts of India, there's, call it misfortune, that happens more often than you might dream, that somebody who is in a position to inherit valuables from a relative will go to a civic official of some kind, pay them a very small bribe, and have the person declared legally dead. And when that happens, usually the person, for all intents, all purposes, all whatever, is dead. They can do nothing. They will go around, they'll walk into a government office to complain about this, and the clerk will look at them and ask them to wait a moment, go back, look them up, and come back and say, no, you're dead. That's it. So they lose all their property. It really is a terrible thing, because they can't work, they can't do anything, and they're shamed. And in the numbers that we were told by the people connected with this is in... For example, the province that Lal Bihari lives in, that there were at any one time in the neighborhood of 10,000 of these living dead persons.
Wow.
And most of them, that was it. Their life was effectively over, even though it wasn't over.
But are they above the law then? Could they commit crimes?
They're not. That, too, is a very good question, because some of them tried to get arrested. They would go and try to commit the kind of crime that really didn't cause any harm, and they would try to get arrested. It was an organized strategy for a while, and police would not arrest them.
Wow.
Because their intention was exactly what you're suggesting.
Yeah.
That once you get into the court system, something's got to give. But they were not allowed even that first ghost of a centimeter into the system. But Lal Bahari is probably the first person who figured out a solution to this, at least sometime. And it comes down to shame. What he did was gather a bunch of people together. Let's form this association of dead persons. And just, we will go as an organized group to the office of this public official. We will have public demonstrations. And that started to change things. And then they started to run some of these dead people for public office. They've been doing this now for many years. And every election cycle, I don't think they've yet gotten somebody elected, but every election cycle, at least for a long time, they were getting closer and closer to getting somebody elected. And he himself did manage to get his life back, quite literally,
oh, wow,
at least legally, and to get most of his property back.
Let's take a little bit of a look, Mark, at how you got involved in looking at improbable research. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, I got involved, in essence, by being born. I've always liked this kind of stuff. Even when I was a little kid, I used to collect all sorts of stuff about science. And also, I was one of those little kids who liked reading newspapers, and I would collect odd stories. And I also like to write things. So I've managed now as an adult to keep doing all the things I was doing as a little kid. And I went to Harvard. I majored in applied mathematics. And then I was off doing software stuff and a software company. But I was always writing these things on the side, just inflicting them on a few friends. And then now, a little more than 20 years ago, I finally wondered, can I get something published someplace? Because I'd never tried. So I took a few things I'd written, I think they were funny things about science, and sent them off to a science journal. A few weeks later, I got a message on my phone machine. Hi, this is so-and-so. I'm the publisher of the journal. We got your articles. Would you be the editor of the journal? So that's how I got started. And for about 3 or 4 years, I was leading a double life, software during the day and this at night. And I started the Ig Nobel ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year especially, got very lucky. A whole bunch of things just happened to go right. And because of that, we were able to then start doing things on a bigger and bigger scale. And now we are the microscopic juggernaut that we are.
Do you remember the first story that you wrote?
I think it was mostly a couple of collections of things. One of them was it was a column of miscellaneous things called scientific gossip. I always like that idea of gossip done as a scientist would do it, and maybe about things in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that were in that and some of the other stuff, I then started turning into regular columns in the magazine, although I didn't use that column title too much longer. I should resurrect it at some point.
But was it, in terms of, because there was one award you gave a few years back to a woman who discovered that cows give more milk if they have names than if they don't have names. Was there a particular story of that kind of nature that you first heard and thought, oh my God, why is this not in the news? Someone needs to cover this.
As I said, since I was a little kid, that's the way the whole world seemed to me. I was, I guess, an unusual little kid. And I'm so happy that the people didn't hold that against me too much.
So how do you actually define improbable research then? What does it mean to you?
To me, it means things that will strike you being you yourself or you in general, as unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
But that covers a lot of ground. Something's unlikely. If you haven't encountered something, if you simply have had no reason ever to run into or to think about it, it's going to strike you as being pretty unlikely. And then once you look at it, that may change pretty quickly. But until it does, it's going to strike you as strange. And I think, too, there's this funny thing if you write about science and try to do it in a way that's funny. If you're making jokes or telling jokes, that's one thing, but that's not really what I do. But if you're trying to just describe this stuff in a way that's funny, there are some things that are going to be funny to anybody, anywhere. But there's a lot of other stuff that to anybody who's never encountered it, it's going to be very funny the first time. It's just almost unthinkable. And looking backwards in schools almost everywhere, and almost always for as long as most people have been made to go to schools, when you're taught about science, you're taught about the history of things in science. And really, that's usually taught as a long series of great scientific breakthroughs. You know, James Watt did this, and you know, Newton did that, and there's a long, long list, and they discovered this. It's a great breakthrough. And I think that almost nothing would be given that name afterwards, a breakthrough, unless before that moment it was unthinkable or it seemed ridiculous. And it's sort of fun reading, paying attention in the news to scientific things. You'll hear things in the news for a long time if you look for them about science. And at first they're reported just in little bits and pieces as, ah, ha, 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 here's something that one of those scientists is doing. Mm-hmm. And then somehow it becomes clearly important to everybody. Maybe now there are machines that have this inside. Or maybe there were satellites that are held up and we were able to send them up. And we knew they were going to stay up because somebody did this. And now it's no longer ridiculous at all. It's just, well, it's mundane. Mm. And looking back, people say, oh, it was a great breakthrough when so-and-so figured out how to get a satellite to re-enter the atmosphere without burning up. When I was a freshman in college, I was taking a math class, and we had a professor who was a great storyteller, but he was not a very good teacher for us because he would start to tell a story using some math that we had to learn, and then he'd get so involved in certain stories that we were lost, all of us, and he was covering blackboard, a hole in the blackboard with this one little subtopic of a subtopic in, for 25 minutes, and there was one day especially, we all walked out of there looking at each other, and the grad students who were the teaching assistants had positioned themselves at the doors and were grabbing each and every one of us and said, what he told you today, don't worry about that. You don't have to learn that. You won't be able to understand that for years. That's what he did. That was what made him famous. He's the guy who figured out how to get a spacecraft back into the atmosphere without burning up. And that's what he was explaining, the mathematics of it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. We had even more respect for him after that.
Yeah.
But we also started to understand that sometimes you're going to be able to learn everything that's explained to you in class, and sometimes maybe that's just a general guideline of a direction.
Had he already done it?
Yeah. It had been years and years before that when he was a young guy that he'd figured that out.
Let's move on to look at the actual Ig Nobel Awards then. You've already slightly described the very first occasion that he held them. I mean, the first thing to say, apart from the fact that there are, there's a few slightly more jokey prizes, like the economics prize and an art prize and things, but in the main, what we're talking about here is real science, isn't it? I mean, all of these things are generally proper science.
Well, that's your opinion. To us, everything, the whole universe, is one big pool of possibly interesting things. So we give 10 prizes a year, and they're all for the same criterion. There's just the one criterion, that it makes people laugh and then makes them think. It's not so easy as you might think to meet that, because we've got to be able to describe these things in about a sentence in a way that anybody, anywhere, in any country, will understand what the thing is and understand why it's funny. It doesn't work if we just simply say we're giving them a prize because it's funny. If you go and look it up, you'll see it's funny. And that, there's no point in our doing that. It's got to be something that we can describe in a pithy little story. Yeah. And in fact, it's more complicated than that because we know it's going to go through Reuters and Associated Press and all the wire services and go around the world and get translated into many languages. And so we have to try to craft the wording so that idea comes through clearly. And then we know every time it gets to a newspaper or a radio station or something, it's got to go through an editor who may know nothing about the subject, and then through the writer, and then somebody else is probably going to stick a headline on. So we try to write these little one-sentence descriptions as stories that are so bulletproof, and worded so clearly that nobody can do damage to this and turn it into something else. And most of the prizes we give are in topics in science, but not all of them. It really can be about anything. We've given out prizes in art, and the science ones, as with everything else, some of them go to people who are professional scientists or whatever in the field. Some go to people who not only have no professional connection, it's occasionally given them to children, but sometimes it's to people who never thought of what they did in connection at all to science or something. It's just when you stand and look at it from outside their little community, well, it most certainly does relate to that. And that's part of what makes it funny sometimes. It's just you see it from a different context, and it's funny, and it may be funny and terrible, or it may be funny and wonderful. Some of the, if you look through the list of winners, and there have been about 200 of them now, I've been doing it 10 a year for 20 years, you'll probably pick out some that you think are, these are, this is what they did there, that's good for the world.
Yeah.
And you'll see some others and you'll decide almost immediately, that's terrible, and I'm glad they got some kind of prize. But the fun thing for us, or a fun thing, is when we hear any two people go through a list, even of the 10 winners from a particular year, and start talking about it, quite often they will disagree violently about which ones are good and which are bad. And we think every time we hear that happen, we think, we've done a good job here. Well, all we do is, and when I write anything anywhere, in the Guardian column and any place else, all I'm trying to do is tell some story so clearly and simply that somebody will understand the gist of it. And they'll be so curious, they'll go off and find all the details. I shouldn't have to tell them the whole story, and probably I can't. I don't know enough. And most things in science and everything else, if you want to be truthful, there is no whole story. It's something that's an ongoing soap opera, and it's messy, which is wonderful. So I don't pretend I'm telling the whole story, and I don't want to try.
You just raised the idea of the sort of the dichotomy of good and bad. And you know, most award ceremonies are, you know, the Oscars are there for what's supposedly the best films, and then there'll be in a celebrity magazine the worst dressed celebrities or something. So these things, there's a very good distinction between good and bad. But the Ig Nobel Prizes are not about that, are they? So how do you...
No. Far as I'm aware, we're the only prize that's like that. Good and bad are completely irrelevant to us. Important and completely unimportant is worth it. It's just, does it make people laugh and then make them think?
But there's some prizes, like I really love this one. A prize went to the execs of Enron and 26 other companies for using the mathematical concept of imaginary numbers in their business.
For adapting the mathematical concept of imaginary numbers in the business world.
They probably didn't show up for the award, I imagine. But
on some of the big group awards to large organizations like that, there have been a few awards like that. We usually will make some attempt to find somebody, but the big organization, where it's something that they may or may not be truly proud of, it's difficult.
But did that come internally from you guys, of going, have you noticed that they've absolutely beautifully use the concept of
it just was so clear to us.
That's
one way of looking at what they did.
Yes. Yeah.
And let's see, other organizations that we haven't managed to find somebody. Quite typically, we will be able to talk to somebody, often to quite a few people, but nobody wants to be the one who officially says we're going to make a statement one way or another. And in fact, in almost all those cases, that's what they decide. We have no comment. Sometimes they're actually pretty pleased to be getting an award on a personal level, but they don't want to make a comment. We gave a prize to the Coca-Cola Company of Great Britain. It was the chemistry prize a number of years ago. I don't remember the exact wording, but it was for inventing a substance called Dasani, you may remember. Bottled
water. It was a water, yeah.
And the story of that, and again, I'm sorry I don't remember the wording we use. So my version today is not as concise or clear, but they started selling it here and marketing it, and it was expensive. It was given the aura of a very important and prestigious thing for you to be able to purchase and drink. And then the news came out that this important, prestigious drink, the water, was being taken directly from the same company that supplies all the municipal water for London.
That's just from a tap, basically.
and then it came out a few weeks later that it wasn't just that water, that there was some additive to improve the flavor or something that was put into it, but there were some impurities which often would undergo a chemical reaction and turn into something that was listed as being a very dangerous cancer-producing substance. And so the moment that came out, the Coca-Cola Company pulled it off the market, which was the sensible thing. And it was shortly after that that they were awarded this prize. And it was one of those cases where at the Ig Nobel ceremony, although we had most of that year's winners come to the ceremony, the Coca-Cola Company of Great Britain could not or would not join us at the event.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm with guest host Dan Schreiber, and we're talking to Mark Abrahams about the Ig Nobel Awards and improbable research. So, Mark, you just again described about, you just mentioned the fact that most people come to the award ceremonies. I want to talk a little bit about how the awards are received by the scientists themselves. So, reading down the list of the 2010 winners, almost everybody that was up for the award came to receive it at the awards ceremony.
That's right. That's been true for many years now. The first few years, of course, we didn't quite know what we were doing. When you start something, you have an idea. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing now is essentially the same idea, but we fleshed it out and we found a few ways of refining it. And the first few years, it simply did not occur to us that if we invited all the winners, almost all of them might come. So we would usually invite a few, and most of the ones we invited came, and then it dawned on us, why don't we invite all of them, see what happens? And we don't have any money. This is almost entirely a volunteer effort. We finance it by selling tickets. We have to rent the theater. We have it in the biggest, oldest meeting place at Harvard. It's a very imposing, wonderful theater. It's so dignified that, you know, when you're doing something that you hope will be funny in this intensely dignified place, the building is helping you immensely. And we always sell it out. It's 1,200 people, and people come from around the world to be there and televise it live on the internet, and reporters come, and, you know, we have these famous scientists and all. So it's a very, you know, fun, odd atmosphere. But we tell the winners that we would love to have you come, but we have no way of providing you with airfare or anything. But so you'll have to come at your own expense. But if you get over here and you need a place to stay, we can arrange for you to be a guest in somebody's home for a few nights. And that's always worked out pretty well. And most of them come. And we also ask them to keep this secret until the ceremony happens. So most of the winners know quite a bit in advance, because they've got to disrupt their lives. You know, if they're whatever they're doing professionally, they're going to have to rearrange their schedule and all. And some of them go to great lengths. There was one winner. It was a professor from Australia who came over. He was part of a project that's still ongoing. I think it maybe is about 70 or 80 years in length at this point. It's looking at what happens to some dried pitch, some dried tar. They took some tar and they put it into a funnel and blocked up the funnel and let it harden for about 2 years. So this tar is really solid. Pretty close to solid, and then they snipped off the bottom, so there's now an opening to the funnel, and they just left it there and they watched. And after about 9 years, a drop of pitch emerged, and then they kept watching. And about every 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years, another drop of pitch came, and they started to graph this. And so you can see over the, you know, more than half century, this line of how often it takes for one more thing. And the original guy retired. He handed it off to a young professor about 1960-61. His name is John Maidstone, and he's the one who came, and this was probably about 8 years ago, by which time he was, I think, on the verge of retirement and looking for some new young professor to hand it over to. And he and his wife came from Australia. It's a long journey from Australia. It's, you know, halfway around the world. And when he got there, he told me that his wife was with him, but he had not told her why they were coming. The first moment she knew why they were making this journey was as the airplane was landing in Boston. And then he swore her to secrecy for another day. So this is good. Most of the winners carry things on in some nice spirit. That's potential winners outside the window, yeah. Children, I think.
But that's, I love, the thing I love about those stories are outside of the actual experiment, which are funny in their own right. It's the length of time, the dedication that goes towards some of them. And you had a winner who spent 60 years clicking the knuckles of one hand.
Oh yeah, Dr. Donald Unger. When he was, I think, in his 20s, he started an experiment where he was trying to discover what happens. Is there a bad consequence if you click your knuckles, if you crack your knuckles?
Wasn't he just told there was by his parents or something?
Yeah.
Like his mum said, don't do
that. Yeah, his mother,
like that.
He was interested in this question because growing up, he loved to crack his knuckles. He was very good at it, and his mother would always tell him, don't do that, you'll get arthritis of the fingers. When he got to be a young adult, his mother wasn't there, so he could crack his knuckles as often as he wanted. And by that time, he was a doctor. And so he thought, well, I'll do this as an experiment. So he started every day, and from what he said, he really did stick to this. Every day, he would crack the knuckles of one hand, but he would try to never, ever crack the knuckles of the other. He said that got violated a couple times because they would crack spontaneously every now and then. But other than that, he said it was always the knuckles of the one hand. And after, I believe it was 50 years, he wrote this up as a short report. He sent it into a medical journal that published it. We gave him the prize, and he came back, and he cracked his knuckles for the crowd. And then he started talking with great glee evident about how he was doing this to spite his mother.
That's fantastic. But you've also, in the ceremonies, they're quite interesting in their own right, because that is, it's effectively feels a bit like of a joke event in its own right. There was, I don't know if you still have, but the little girl who, if she gets bored during a speech, is that the idea?
Yeah,
that
there are lots of parts. We thought a lot when we started this about the fact that we're doing a ceremony, and all of us like to make fun of ceremonies that are dull, and I'm sure most ceremonies, and public events that you have to endure. Mm-hmm. So as the years went on, we started, as experiments every time, taking one more piece from another kind of ceremony and sticking it in and doing something to it. And we'd always take the kind of piece you had to endure.
Yeah.
For example, everybody has sat through a lot of school assemblies and other things where some officious person, usually an older person, gets up and is supposed to welcome you, the crowd. And you know that they're going to go on and on and on. You know it. And often it's an older woman who is very distinguished in some way, and because people are taught to be more polite to older women than to anybody else, at least officially, she has all the more power to spew words for hours without being able to do anything. So we recruited somebody who fit that description and explained what we're doing. We don't want to be putting her in a bad position. And at the start of the ceremony, I always introduce whoever it is who will deliver the traditional Ig Nobel welcome speech. At which point, a man in a tuxedo escorts this woman, who is always dressed the way an older authority figure, across the stage very slowly. It's a great ceremony. And then she comes up to the microphone, and she'll usually make some preparation, perhaps take a book of notes out and look through the notes and put her glasses on and make sure that they're seated properly and look around, and then she'll look at the crowd and she'll say, "Welcome, welcome," and then she leaves. So that kind of thing. Mm. And a lot of the things, we have a number of things that are small that are just done for that purpose, to tweak the history of things we've all had to endure, but those are all short. There are many little pieces of the ceremony that are there that are funny. We chose to make them funny, but they're really there because they solve some problem. And the one that has gotten to be best known, and I think the one we're most proud of, is to solve the problem that at most awards ceremonies, think about the Academy Awards, that's the one in everybody's mind, there are a lot of people who are expected to give speeches. And they are told over and over again to keep those speeches short. But of course, people have more good things to say. And so most people speak a little long. Where there are a lot of people, the night gets really, really, really long. Nobody likes that. And you've seen all kinds of things people have tried. If you're the organizer of one of these events, it's sort of a two-sided problem that you're dealing with. One is, if you've invited these people to come and speak, especially if they've done something odd, you know, they're good enough to come and get up and talk in public. You don't, or at least we do not want to ever put them in a position where they're uncomfortable or might be embarrassed or humiliated. We try very, very hard to make sure that's not going to happen. And the other is, if you're the organizer, if you're doing something to keep people brief, you don't want to look like an ogre about it. You don't want to look like you're forcing them in any way. So you want these things to happen in some way that feels happy and welcome and good to everybody. And we finally came up with the idea that 8-year-old girls, there's something, there's a certain kind of power that some 8-year-old girls have. Not all, but there's some 8-year-old girls who just have, there's some variety of self-confidence and degree of self-confidence that you never ever see in any adult. And you never see it, at least almost never, in a little boy. It's always a little girl, and it's only around that age. You don't see it before, and afterwards things change, especially when puberty comes. But at that age, there's some. So we thought, let's see if we can find one of those special 8-year-old girls. And we looked around, and we found one. And I won't tell you how we choose. We have all kinds of ways to make sure that we've got a girl who really does have that talent. And at the start of the night, I introduce her. She sits on the stage the whole time. We call her Miss Sweetie Pooh. So it's a very, very cute little 8-year-old girl. And I introduce her at the start so everybody understands how this is going to work. And I explain that whenever Miss Sweetie Pooh feels that somebody has talked long enough, she will let them know. And then I ask her to demonstrate. So this wee little girl walks across the stage up to the person at the microphone, and she looks up at that person and she says, "Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored." And she doesn't stop until they do. And it works. We have never seen any adult who was able to withstand that very long at all. And every year or two, we need to come up with a new Miss Sweetie Pooh because they just insist on not staying 8 years old.
It'll be interesting when you finally get an Ig Nobel winner who has worked out how to deal with an 8-year-old who will not stop telling you to stop.
Many have tried.
Have they?
Oh, yeah. After a few years, people see the videotapes of the ceremony or they'll read accounts in magazines or see TV reports or whatever. And so, and we tell them, too. You know, we do not want any of the winners to be in a position, again, where they're you know, surprised in an embarrassing way. So we tell them this is going to happen, which itself is good encouragement to them to keep the speech short. And after about 4 or 5 years, there was a year when somebody, and I think it was a business school professor who had won a prize, started giving a speech, and he was going on and on. A little girl came up and started saying, "Please stop, I'm bored, please stop, I'm bored." And he reached in his pocket and he pulled out a dollar bill, and he handed it to her. And Miss Sweetie Pooh stopped for a moment, took the dollar bill, looked at him, nodded, said, "Thank you. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored." And others have tried other things, and nothing anybody has tried works, we're happy to say.
I think we should spend the last part of the show just picking out some examples of the previous winners and talking about them briefly. But before we do, just going on from what Dan has just said about people trying to subvert Miss Sweetie Pooh, the 2011 awards are going to be the 21st awards. Mm-hmm. So you've been doing this for a long time. Do you think there's any way now in which you're almost encouraging this type of people to come up with stuff that might win them an Ig Nobel award, that you're somehow skewing the research?
It's possible, but it's also irrelevant because you've got to be selected to win. And starting with the second year, because the first year got so much publicity around the world, starting with just the second year, we had a lot of people who were nominating themselves. And anybody can send in a nomination. We get a lot. We get something like 7,000 new nominations every year. And of those, every year, pretty reliably, something between 10 and 20% are people nominating themselves. They almost never win. Because to have this quality, you know, it's easy, relatively easy to do one or the other, to make something that will make people laugh, but it doesn't stick in their head in a way they really want to know more. And there are lots of things you can do that will make people think about it. I mean, they're interesting, but they're not funny in that immediate way. The combination, it's an unusual kind of combination, and it's very hard to manufacture. And almost all of the ones where people set out with that as their main goal, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't. So people are welcome to try, and we have absolutely nothing against giving a prize to somebody who's tried. It's just, it's rare for those things to make it through.
I wonder, do you ever have it the other way around? Because I imagine if you set up a subdivision faculty within the organization of non-scientists who've noticed certain things, almost in the same way that stand-up comedians do, you know, observations about stuff they see, but they don't have the scientific qualification to be able to test these subjects. And you must have a whole batch of scientists who are going, I just need that great idea to spend the next 60 years of my life looking into.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. And it's a sad thing for the world that that doesn't happen nearly as often as it could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I have a bunch of stuff, and I'm sure everyone does, if you put that on a simple thing like Twitter.
You need both parts, though. Having a brilliant, funny idea is good, but that alone is not going to win you a prize. You have to have done something with it, because that's what really makes it a great story, that not only did somebody think of this, but they spent the next 10 years working.
Yes.
I'll give you an example, and this is the same example of... Every prize has a category. We give a physics prize, we give a chemistry prize most years, a peace prize, and the categories can change. And every year there are a few things where there's no obvious category. We have to devise a category name. Occasionally that's really hard because what somebody's done is so far outside any existing category, it's a struggle, and you know, we're happy to have this struggle. And maybe the chief example is the prize we gave to a man named Troy Hurtubise, who's from Canada, North Bay, Canada. Troy Hurtubise spent, well, at the time he got the prize, which is now about 12 years ago, I think, he had spent about 7 years inventing, building, and personally testing a suit of armor that he hoped would protect him against grizzly bears. And he went about testing this thing, as he built new models, they got more and more elaborate, and he had no money, so he'd scrounge the parts from the dump in the town where he lived. So the early versions were mostly old equipment that hockey players would wear and had thrown out because it was... And then things got much, much more elaborate, titanium layers and all kinds of stuff. And he would have people film him or videotape him as he tests these things. And he started out just with testing. You don't want to test it against a grizzly bear because grizzly bears are far more powerful and destructive than almost anybody can imagine.
Yeah.
So you want to be sure by the time you go out and try it on a bear that you've tried it on things that are just as powerful some other way. So he started with small things. He'd have people throw small weights at him and then bigger weights. And then as the suits got better, the tests got much more elaborate to the point where there are films of him being taken to the side of a cliff and pushed off the side of a cliff. There's one where they took him to a biker bar out in the wilds of Canada someplace, and they went inside and found the biggest hulking bikers that they could find and asked them to come outside, and they gave them baseball bats and clubs and asked them to beat the crap out of Troy. So there are films of that. My favorite thing in all this collection of films is you see Troy in his suit, which is really elaborate, and it's elaborate to the point where he barely could move. In fact, in the early versions of the suit, if he were to take a step, he would fall over and not be able to get up. So it was one of those suits. He's standing in the middle of a big, flat, open field, and you're watching the film of this, and then you see from the side a Jeep comes in, traveling about 40 miles an hour, and whams into Troy. And there's a nice documentary film that the Canadian Film Board made about Troy. It's called Project Grizzly. You can even see the whole thing for free online. It's worth seeing. And as they're showing this particular one, somebody is interviewing Troy, watching these, again, old films of himself. And Troy's saying, yeah, we did that 17 times. So when we gave Troy an Ig Nobel Prize, one of our problems was, what category is this prize in? And we finally decided we need a new field for this. So we gave Troy the Ig Nobel Prize, the first ever awarded in the field of safety engineering.
What was his practical element of it? Was he just really pissed off with
bears? How much time do you have? He's just written a book about it.
Has he?
In fact, I just wrote one of my columns in the paper about a month or so ago was about the book, which it's an unusual book, I'll say that.
Right.
And his story has about why he did it has grown and changed somewhat over time.
Okay.
I just love the idea of going hiking somewhere in the wilds wearing a massive metal suit you can barely carry and then tripping over and not being able to get up once the bear comes
inside. Stuck out there.
The bear gradually learns to pick away at bits of it over the months.
Yep. It just sounds like something to brag about at dinner parties. We met Troy, kicked the ass out of the bear recently. What?
Yeah.
Yeah. And now I think you have a pretty good appreciation of why he won an Ig Nobel Prize.
Exactly.
Let's look at a couple of other of recent examples then. And let's first of all talk about the last year's engineering prize, which is a method for collecting whale snot using a remote control helicopter.
It was an improved method of collecting whale.
So they already had.
This was a team of three scientists based partly in London and partly in Mexico, and their innovation. Scientists for years had various methods of collecting whale snot. It's a separate question why they would need to.
Yeah, we don't have to go into that.
We can if you like. It's an interesting story, which is part of the reason that they ended up winning the Nobel Prize. But the previous methods all had great drawbacks. The innovation here was to use a remote-controlled helicopter that hovers over the whale as the whale's out there, hovers above the blow spout and collects what comes out, which is the proper word for it. We have been told by scientists who work in that field that really is whale snot. That's what they're collecting. And then they're going to be analyzing what's in it, the bacteria and whatever, usually. So for coming up with this improved method, they received an Ig Nobel Prize. And it was especially fun when they came to the ceremony.
Did they bring the remote helicopter?
No, they didn't. But they didn't have to. All information about the winners is secret until that moment. In fact, we've got several Nobel Prize winners on stage who are going to shake their hands and hand the prizes. They don't know who the winners are or what they've done until that moment on stage. So you get to see all of these people reacting to these things. And you can see this great joy and many other things reflected in people's faces. And the whole audience there has just learned about this method of whale snot. So simply to see the people there and that they've come and they are talking to you. They're there and you'll be able to shake their hand later. It's stunning in the best way.
So okay, the next one from last year, which is great, is this somebody proving the idea that swearing helps to relieve pain.
This was a widespread belief for a long time, but nobody had a lot to try to test whether that's really true or not. And so this team decided to test it. And the method they used was, let's see if I can tell this story properly. They first got some swear words from each of the volunteers who was going to be tested, because you want to make sure that these are swear words that mean something to that person. They're not just words that are supposed to be bad to this person, they really do carry some power. So they asked people, give us a list of some words that for you are really good swear words. And then they would ask them for a separate list of just innocuous words. They'd say, tell me five words that you use to describe a table or something. So they come up with, for every person, these two lists of words. And then they would get a bucket of ice water. And I don't know if you have ever been in the situation of plunging your hand into a bucket of ice water. But if you do and you leave it there, it hurts. And you're not going to be able to leave it there very long. What they would do then for each person is they would get the person and they would ask the person to sit here and plunge one of your hands into the bucket of ice water. While you're doing that, here's one of these lists of paper, or here's one of the words you told us. Just say this word over and over again. And they would do it a couple of times, once with one of the swear words, the person with the hand plunged in the bucket of ice water, repeating the swear word over and over, and then with one of the innocuous words. And they found pretty consistently that when people were saying the swear word, they would hold their hand under the ice water for a lot longer. And they really were able to endure this pain much longer. And there were lots of little things. With most of these things, the details sometimes go off in wonderful directions and are stories into themselves. So one of the little things they say they discovered was that this only works for people who don't swear a lot. If you're one of those people who uses swear words as, it's every third word out of your mouth, sorry, you do not have this power to benefit yourself anymore. But if you don't say swear words very often, these things are quite potent, and of benefit to you.
I love I read one that said that asthma symptoms can be treated by roller coaster ride.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
That's exactly what it was.
And also, I really enjoyed watching the acceptance speech and demonstration of the woman who won the prize for creating the bra that could be quickly disassembled and turned into a gas mask to save yourself in the case of a gas attack. And the kind of joke that she threw in, saying, you've got one for yourself and another for any one of the men you want to pick to survive into the apocalypse with you.
Yeah, it gives enormous power to the woman who's wearing that bra when the emergency hits. Yes, Dr. Elena Bodnar, and when she was a young doctor, she grew up in Ukraine, and as a young doctor, she treated a lot of victims of the Chernobyl power plant disaster afterward. And so she said that doctors, after a few years, realized that the bulk of the medical damage didn't come from what they'd expected. It wasn't that the radioactivity would get on your skin and cause that. It was almost all the really bad stuff, the particles, the radioactive particles that people had breathed in. So they came to realize that if, when the disaster hit, people had any kind of mask, didn't even have to be a really good quality, but just anything to keep these big particles out, there would have been a lot less medical horror resulting from this. And she kept thinking about that. And years later, when she had a baby, and the baby was playing with her bra one day, and she thought, this would make a good face mask. And then as she thought it out more, she realized this would make two good face masks. So she designed a variation on the standard bra, and it's got clasps in the middle as well as on the back, so you can quickly separate it into two separate face masks. And then she patented this. And yeah, when she talks about it and when she demonstrates, she explains that you not only can save your life, but you can save the life of some innocent bystander, and you can choose who that will be. She has since founded a company, and they now manufacture this. You can buy these. And it was funny when, in Japan when the nuclear power plant disaster hit there, but I happened to be traveling with her in England and Scotland when that happened. We were doing our annual tour for the Ig Nobel thing. And so she was watching the news very carefully every day. And she said, you know, Japan is one of the companies where the sales of our bra have been highest. So that's a fortunate thing.
Oh, wow. Well, we're running out of time, but let's just quickly finish off with another example. And I think this is probably one of the examples you've mentioned about people that aren't necessarily scientists but have come up with something. And I'm thinking of the example of Len Fisher of Bath, who calculated the optimum way to dunk a biscuit in a cup of tea.
Yes. He is a scientist. But that, whether he was or not, is completely irrelevant. If that had been a 10-year-old kid doing it, we probably would have awarded that prize. But we gave a prize, it's a similar kind of example, to, she must have been about 15 or 16 when she did it, a girl named Jillian Clark, who was an American high school student. And she did the first documented scientific test of what people call the five-second rule. And I'm sure you're familiar with the idea that if you accidentally drop a piece of food on the floor, is it safe to pick it up and eat it?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people will tell you, well, I've heard there's a rule of thumb on that, that if it's been there 5 seconds or less, it's safe to eat. And so she was working one summer in a laboratory, you know, just some summer job, and somehow somebody came up with the idea of, we can test this, and Jillian was the person who carried out the test. And so she won her prize and came to the ceremony. And then we started getting letters over the next year from a lot of scientists, a lot of biologists around the world. They were sort of angry letters, angry at themselves, saying, I had been saving this topic for some year when I had a little free time so I could run these tests in my lab and publish it and become the first scientist to publish on this. And now I've been scooped by a high school girl.
So we're out of time. So Mark, thank you very much for coming in and speaking to us today. Dan, thank you for co-hosting.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
We've managed to get through nearly an hour without once mentioning rectal foreign bodies, so I think we did.
I frequently get through an hour without mentioning that. Is life different for you?
It's a big thing.
It's different in the UK, yeah.
Oh, you should listen to the rest of the Little Adam podcast. We didn't even touch on the homosexual necrophiliac ducks. Yeah. Back fellatio, that was another one. But
yeah, that was a separate prize.
Yeah.
The winner of that prize, by the way, that was a large team, partly from China, partly from the UK. And the British scientist came over to the ceremony, accepted the prize, and then he felt that there might be people there who didn't understand some of the technical aspects of what's involved in bat fellatio, because they won for being the first to document the existence of fellatio in fruit bats. So in case there were some people there, including some of the famous scientists on stage from other fields who did not quite understand what was going on, he felt it was necessary to bring two hand puppets of fruit bats and demonstrate. And not only that, he brought some extra pairs of hand puppets, and he handed a pair of these to each of the distinguished scientists on stage. And we also had a few other people. Neil Gaiman, the writer, was there. And so we had six or eight people, each with a pair of hand puppets, demonstrating to each other exactly how this works. And then we had to stop them because they would have gone on for hours.
Wow, good joke.
He thought that funny as well.
You could have a hand puppet out there on the street demonstrating. I'm going to stay in here for a while just in case.
Again, Mark, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.